Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am going to cover in this audio Genesis chapter 13, verses 1 through 18, the entire chapter, which I will call Abram Separates from Lot. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, Abraham is called, either from Ur or Haran or both, to go to the promised land, the land of Israel. He takes out, he lands there, he goes to Shechem, moves down to Bethel. There he goes down to the Negev. There's a famine, and he goes down to Egypt. He takes his wife down to Egypt, and his wife ends up in the Pharaoh's harem as a concubine. He leaves Egypt after the plague convinces the Pharaoh to expel Sarah from the harem. He takes Sarah and goes back into the promised land, and he goes back up to Bethel. And that's where we'll take it up here in Genesis 13. He's back into Canaan. He's back to Canaan. Genesis 13, 1 through 4. So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife and all that belonged to him, and Lot with him. Now, Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold. It's something I just noticed here. Lot went down to escape the famine along with Abram and Sarah, which I hadn't noticed before. Verse 2, now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold. He went on his journeys from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. That's referring to the second place on Abraham's sojourn as he came to the land. He started out in Shechem in the mid-center of Canaan, went down further south to Bethel, about 10 miles north of Jerusalem, between Bethel and Ai. That was his second place. And he's coming back there to his second place, the campsite between Bethel and Ai. Verse 4, to the place of the altar which he had made there formerly on his first trip. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. So he's now in Bethel. Now he went up from Egypt to the Negev. That's because the Negev is higher geographically than Egypt is. Canaan is a plateau. Egypt is very low. Now he left Egypt, so that perhaps indicates that the famine in Canaan must have been over. But maybe not. Abram had been booted out of Egypt against his will. If you recall, the Pharaoh got mad at him because there was plagues when he took Sarah into the Pharaoh's harem. So it might have been divine providence that protected Abram as he was forced out of Egypt into Canaan. We don't know, but anyway, he went up there. Went up to the Negev, that's the desert in Canaan, south of Beersheba that runs all the way down to Egypt. He and his wife and all that belonged with him and Lot with him. Now, Abram was very rich. Abram, remember, escaped a famine in Israel. Genesis 12:10, last chapter. Now, there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land, a severe famine. Abraham changed his circumstances in tough times, and he prospered. He was actually richer when he left Egypt than when he entered Egypt, despite the famine. That just shows how God takes care of his people. Abraham died a rich man, started out with nothing, and ended up very wealthy. He was just like the children of Israel. They were slaves, but when they left Israel on the Exodus, they had a good bit of money. Exodus 3:22, but every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house. That means every Jewish woman. Slave, articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing they'll ask for, and you will put them on your sons and daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians. That's metaphorically speaking. They didn't actually steal it. You notice they asked for it, and the Egyptians were so happy to get rid of the Israelites, they said, take it, take it, take it. Exodus 12:36, and the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Again, that's metaphorically. God didn't tell them to steal. The articles were voluntarily given to the Israelites. So they left Egypt loaded with money, and Abraham left Egypt loaded with money. Again, God takes adverse circumstances and takes care of his people. That's a good application. Now, it is said in verse 2 that not only was Abram rich in livestock as a nomad, a pastoral nomad, a lot of that stuff came from the Pharaoh that gave him camels and female donkeys and camels and sheep and goats and all that, but also Abraham had silver and gold in verse 2. Now, that's kind of unusual. Silver and gold is very heavy bullion. It wasn't coins, of course. They didn't have coins then. But carrying raw silver and gold is heavy, and nomads have to move all over the place. That's a pain to carry that stuff, but Abraham had it anyway. Where did he get it? John Gill speculates that Abram must have sold some of his agricultural goods and livestock in Egypt. Adam Clark sort of disagrees. He says wealth in pastoral times did include silver and gold. I don't know, but it definitely wasn't silver and gold coins, which didn't exist. So Abram goes back into the promised land, and he goes as far as Bethel. Actually, it's between Bethel and Ai. So he returns to one of his former stomping grounds, the second place he sojourned at when he came into the land of Israel to start with, the second place after Shechem, which was the first place. Now, Bethel actually, at that time, was called Luz. It was only called Bethel, Beth is house, El is God, the house of God, and it was only afterwards. So this is a little anachronistic reference to Bethel. Remember, Moses wrote this after 400 years or so after Abraham. Now, Bethel means house of God. Let me read you from Eastern's Illustrated Dictionary. It's a place in central Palestine, about 10 miles north of Jerusalem, at the head of the Pass of Michmash and Ai. It was originally the royal Canaanite city of Luz. The name Bethel was at first apparently given to the sanctuary in the neighborhood of Luz and was not given to the city itself until after its conquest by the tribe of Ephraim. When Abram entered Canaan, he formed his second encampment between Bethel and Ai, and on his return from Egypt, he came back to it. By the way, about 10 miles north of Jerusalem is a little valley there. Ai is a little bit to the southwest on the left side as you're looking down at the map of the valley, and Bethel is a little bit to the north and east of there. And Abraham camped in between, and to the east of Bethel there was a mountain range there. All right, so Abraham called upon the name of the Lord on a second visit to Bethel, continuing with Easton's description. Here Jacob, on his way from Beersheba to Haran, had a vision of the angels of God ascending and descending on the ladder whose top reached into heaven, Jacob's ladder. What happened at Bethel. And on his return, he again visited this place where God talked with him. So Jacob went back to Bethel too. There he built an altar and called the place El Bethel, God's house of God, I guess. To this second occasion of God speaking with Jacob at Bethel, Hosea makes reference. In troublous times, the people went to Bethel to ask counsel of God, as we see in Judges. Here the Ark of the Covenant was kept for a long time under the care of Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron. Here also Samuel held in rotation his court of justice. It was included in Israel after the kingdom was divided, and it became one of the seats of the worship of the golden calf. Hence the prophet Hosea calls it in contempt Beth-Aven, i.e. house of idols. Bethel remained an abode of priests even after the kingdom of Israel was desolated by the king of Assyria. At length, all traces of the idolatries were extirpated by Josiah, king of Judah, and the place was still in existence after the captivity. It has been identified with the ruins of Beitin. So here you see that Bethel has a long and glorious and sometimes inglorious history in the history of Israel, so we'll be coming back to Bethel a lot. Now, Ai means ruins. It was one of the, remember, Jacob camped between Ai and Bethel, Ai on the southwest and Bethel on the northeast. Ai was one of the royal cities of the Canaanites, reading from Easton's. It was the scene of Joshua's defeat and afterwards of his victory. That's when Achan, I guess is how you say his name, buried the spoils that were supposed to be dedicated to God. He put them under his tent, brought a curse on the camp. It was the second Canaanite city taken by Israel. It lay rebuilt and inhabited by the Benjamites. It lay to the east of Bethel. Well, Easton says to the east, but not according to BibleAtlas.org, which has it to the west of Ai. Excuse me. Ai is to the, according to BibleAtlas.org, Ai is to the west of Bethel. According to Easton's, it's to the east. Easton's is old. I trust that BibleAtlas.org because it's more modern. The spot which is most probably the site of this ancient city is Haiyan, 2 miles east from Bethel. All right, so whatever. So, now, the place that Abraham stopped in between Ai and Bethel is, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, quote, a conspicuous hill, its topmost summit resting on the rocky slopes below and distinguished by its olive groves, offering a natural base for the altar and a fitting shade for the tent of the patriarch. Well, maybe that'll help us picture a little bit of where he was and what he has done. Afterwards, this place was called Mount Ephraim, 4 miles north of Jerusalem. Some say that later on the altar was destroyed, though people don't know that for sure, as John Gill says. Now, why did Abram worship at this altar between Ai and Bethel? A couple of options. Maybe he was making an offering to repent of his misdeed in Egypt concerning Sarai, his wife, when he said, "Hey, Pharaoh, she's my sister." Or he said he let it be known that it was his sister, and then the Pharaoh heard about it and took her into his harem. Well, I went to a lot of, perhaps casuistry, trying to show that I don't think Abraham did anything wrong. I think if you or I had been in the place of Abraham, we'd have done the same thing. It's a hard question. So I don't think he had anything to repent of. I think that more probably he worship at that altar in order to renew his commitment to God's promises. Remember, land, offspring, and blessings, Lob. Genesis 13, 5 through 7. Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. He came back up from Egypt with Abram, and he's hanging around there near Bethel, where Abraham was. Verse 6, and the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. These were two prosperous people. Verse 7, and there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling then in the land. All right, so Abram and Lot, his nephew Lot, had so much livestock, not enough grass at Bethel to support, not enough water, not enough pasture. John Gill says it was not because some herdsmen were trying to steal the flocks of the other. I can't imagine Abram and Lot would have their herdsmen stealing sheep from each other. It's just there wasn't enough room. Now, why this strange reference to the Canaanite and Perizzite dwelling in the land? Well, and Moses wanted to show there wasn't enough land for Abram and Lot. In writing this passage, Moses wanted to show that there wasn't enough land for Abram and Lot because the land is being shared not only by Abram and Lot, but also by Canaanites and Perizzites. And we're going to talk about Canaanites and Perizzites right now. Perizzite, this is from Easton's again, villagers, dwellers in the open country. These were the agricultural folks. The Canaanitish nation inhabiting the fertile regions south and southwest of Carmel. But now these Perizzites, of course, are down at Bethel, but their main place was in the northwest of Israel, right there, the little crook in the coastline there on that hill there where the beautiful city of Carmel is. I've been there. It is pretty. It's very pretty. And that's where the Perizzites mostly were. They were the graziers, farmers, and peasants of the time. They were to be driven out of the land by the descendants of Abraham, and they are afterwards named among the conquered tribes. Still lingering in the land, however, they were reduced to servitude by Solomon. Now, Canaanites, that's a more generic term. Canaanites included Perizzites, actually, but Canaanites included a bunch of other sub-tribes of the nation of the Canaanites. Let me read you a description of the Canaanites from Easton's. Quote, the descendants of Canaan, the son of Ham, migrating from their original home, which of course would be Ararat from Noah's Ark, they seem to have reached the Persian Gulf and to have there sojourned for some time. They then spread to the west across the mountain chain of Lebanon to the very edge of the Mediterranean Sea, occupying all the land which later became Palestine, also to the northwest as far as the mountain chain of Taurus. Now, the Taurus Mountains are important. They blocked off the southeast corner of the Anatolian Peninsula, which was highlands of grasslands that nomads could wander around on. And this mountain range, if you look at the map of present-day Turkey or ancient Anatolia, the peninsula there, you'll see on the Mediterranean coast at the southeastern end of the Anatolian province, running east to west, is the Taurus Mountains, right around Tarsus, where Paul was from. The Taurus Mountains blocked off Paul from getting into the Anatolian province if he had wanted to go there, which he did, actually. You go through the Cilician Gate, so-called, through the mountain passes, and you're into the Anatolian province, where you go to Pisidian, Antioch, and Iconium, and all those places. So the Taurus Mountains there blocked off the province right around Tarsus, and then all of a sudden it takes a north turn, goes up and separates the Anatolian province from eastern Turkey or Syria, that area, right south of Armenia. So the Canaanites apparently went as far as the Taurus Mountains, according to Easton's here, and then of course they went all down the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, current-day Lebanon, current-day Israel, all down in that area. And that's mostly where they were, and that's why the land is called the Land of Canaan. This group, the Canaanites, was very numerous and broken up into a great many peoples, as we can judge from the list of nations in Genesis 10, the sons of Canaan. Six different tribes are mentioned in Exodus. In Exodus 13, 15, the Perizzites are omitted, the ones that are mentioned here. But then we have other people like the Girgashites, the Canaanites, as distinguished from the Amalekites. Again, that's sometimes a very broad term, sometimes it's not. The Anakim and the Rephaim were dwellers in the lowlands. Tyre and Sidon, the Canaanites' famous cities, were the centers of great commercial activity, and hence the name Canaanite came to signify a trader or merchant. Tyre and Sidon, of course, present-day Lebanon on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. The name Canaanite is also sometimes used to designate the non-Israelite inhabitants of the land in general. In other words, it can be a very general term, or it can be a specific reference to an ethnic group or to a tribe. We go now to Genesis 13, 8 through 9. So Abram said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right, or if to the right, then I will go to the left." Now Abram was gracious enough to give Lot the first choice of the land, even though he was the elder of the two. John Gill says, quote, "The conduct of Abraham was not only disinterested and peaceable, but generous and condescending in an extraordinary degree." Yeah, he was real nice about that. He could have said, "Look, I'm going to pick some land and you take what's left over," but he didn't do that. Abraham said, "Let there be no strife," which shows that there had not been any strife yet, but it was brewing. Just a matter of time, it was going to come, and Abram headed it off. And he says, "I don't want strife, for we are brothers." Now, actually, Abraham was Lot's uncle. They weren't actually blood brothers, so brothers, as the NIV Study Bible says, really means relatives, for we are relatives with each other. Lot, you recall, was the son of Abraham's brother Haran, the one who died in Ur before Abraham left Ur to go to Haran, the city Haran. Genesis 13:10, Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go to Zoar. Now, Adam Clark says that Lot showed no breeding or civility towards Abraham by picking first. That's an opinion. I might be true. I'm not sure it's true. He lifted up his eyes. Gill says it could be the eyes of his understanding. I don't think so. I think here is his physical eyes. Because you can look at Bethel, which is right north of Jerusalem. You can stand there on that high area there and look down over the Dead Sea. You can see a long way to the east of the Dead Sea. I remember as a tour guide driver was driving us in a car out of Jerusalem. As soon as we got outside of the city, I looked over to my left, and there's the Dead Sea. I said, I had no idea you could see the Dead Sea from outside of Jerusalem. You can see a long, long way. So Lot looked and saw all the well-watered land everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, the implication being there it wasn't well-watered after all the volcanoes erupted or whatever happened down there to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Wasn't well-watered anymore, but at that time it was. It was well-watered like the Garden of the Lord. That, of course, is the Garden of Eden. It was well-watered because there was four rivers running through it, the Tigris, the Euphrates, the Pishon, and the Gihon. Now, actually, the area to the east of the Jordan River and also southeast of the Dead Sea where Sodom and Gomorrah were, that area was well-watered according to archaeology, according to the NIV Study Bible says. It's not now. It looks like desolate Mars landscape, but back then it was. Now there's a little phrase here that might be a little confusing, like the Garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. That sounds like Zoar is close geographically to Egypt, which it's not. But so what the way you read this is, the east of the valley of the Jordan was well watered. It was well watered like the Garden of the Lord, the Garden of Eden. It was well watered like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So the land as you go to Zoar down that valley of the Jordan is well watered like the Garden of Eden and like Egypt is well watered. Egypt's well watered because of the Nile. They didn't have to worry about famine. That's why Abram had gone down there, because of the Nile River that provided food even in times of famine. So it's a little bit confusing, but it doesn't mean that Egypt was close to Zoar. Zoar, by the way, is one of the four towns. I think it's roughly four towns that are down there at the south and southeast of the Dead Sea right now, which is right now in the middle of the wilderness. Zoar means small, according to Eastons, a town on the east or southeast of the Dead Sea to which Lot and his daughters fled from Sodom. That's why it's famous, after Sodom got blown up by volcanoes or whatever. That's where Lot and his daughters went to escape. It was originally called Bela. It is referred to by the prophets Isaiah and Jeremiah. Its ruins are still seen at the opening of the ravine of Karak, the Kir Moab referred to in 2 Kings 3, the modern tell Esh Shagur. By the way, they don't know where these towns are. I know I saw on Wikipedia a picture where the Israeli government had marked off where Sodom was and says, no visitors or no trespassing. This is the archaeological site for Sodom. I don't believe that. Well, maybe I'm wrong. I'm not an expert on archaeology, but I'm so used to tour guides telling you that this is where such and such was, and this is where such and such was, and it turns out that nobody really knows where such and such was, like the Garden of Gethsemane. Nobody knows where that was, but they'll tell you. They'll take you in there, charge you some money, and you get to see the place. So anyway, Zoar is south of the Dead Sea. So it's Sodom, Gomorrah, Zoar, Adma, and Zeboim. I said four towns. It's five towns. Those are the five. Sodom and Gomorrah, Zoar, Adma, and Zeboim. Those other towns will show up in later narratives. We go now to Genesis 13, verses 11 through 13. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. In other words, he crossed over the northern top of the Dead Sea and went down the eastern side of the Dead Sea, which is mountainous, but if you go past the mountains, you've got a valley there. And I assume that's where Lot went. Thus they separated Abraham and Lot from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan. That, of course, is what today we would call Israel. While Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. So apparently, Lot took his time before finally settling in Sodom by settling in some of these cities of the valley. This is to the east of the Jordan River. Now, when it says in verse 12 that Abram settled in the land of Canaan, that's using Canaan in the loose sense, not in the particular sense of one of the Canaanite tribes, but in the general sense, the overarching umbrella sense of Canaan. And actually, Canaan could have included the plain of Jordan, or the valley down by the side of the Jordan River, and Sodom and Gomorrah, even though they were a little bit outside of the area we generally call Canaan. So Canaan, it's like all geographical names, they're loose. Canaan proper would not include Sodom and Gomorrah. Here in verse 12, it sounds like there's a distinction between Abram settled in Canaan, Lot settled as in the cities of the valley as far as Sodom. It sounds like they're two different places, and that's because Canaan here is referred to in the strict sense, different from where Lot was, which is Canaan in the loose sense, but it's not Canaan in the strict sense. Verse 13, now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. The name Sodom, according to Easton's dictionary, means burning. The walled, a city in the vale of Siddim. The wickedness of its inhabitants brought down its fire from heaven. You remember the homosexuals down there tried to rape angels who were visiting Lot. The wickedness of its inhabitants brought down fire from heaven by which it was destroyed. The city and its awful destructions are frequently alluded to in Scripture. No trace of it or of the other cities of the plain has been discovered. Now, this was written in the 1800s, and maybe they did discover something in Israel. I don't know. I'm not an archaeological expert. And because I'm not an archaeological expert, I stopped my recording and went to the internet and discovered something interesting here, that in the year 2015, according to a Fox News report, somebody is claiming that he has discovered where Sodom was. Let me read this to you. The archaeological team, directed by Steve Collins of New Mexico's Trinity Southwest University, has been working for 10 years in the Jordan Valley. It now believes it has discovered this magnificent historical site. If confirmed, and notice if confirmed, the discovery could give the archaeological community an invaluable understanding of how people lived during between 3500 BC and 1540 BC, and perhaps most interestingly, the excavations are revealing that life in the city came to an abrupt end during the Middle Bronze Age between 2000 and 1540 BC, which of course is Abraham's time. He was born in 1951, so I think he was about 75 when he came into the land. So this is the beginning of the 19th century BC, the beginning of the 1800s BC, which is right in that time frame. Life came to an abrupt end, seemingly consistent with the biblical story. Preliminary tests reveal there was a stark end of life that lasted for about 700 years. Well, that's very interesting. I looked further, found an Answers in Genesis article in 2017 that says there are two competing sites for ancient Sodom. So it really hasn't been found for sure yet, but people think they're narrowing down on it. I hope they can come to a conclusion one day. I think it's kind of interesting. Now, the people of Sodom are said to be wicked exceedingly, as the NASB puts it, sinners against the Lord. You remember the story about how the homosexuals wanted to come in and have sex with the angels in Lot's house. Now, the people were wicked down there. Sodom is where we get the term sodomy from, homosexuality. Now, Lot might not have known that when he went down there, or he might have gone down there knowing that the place was wicked, but he went anyway because of the good pasture. And so we ask the question, should Lot be held blameworthy because of his choice of abode? Well, in favor of Lot, it seems that he really had no choice. He didn't have enough land. And if when Abram gave him a time to choose, Lot had chosen some other place in Canaan, well, they were full of sinners too. Maybe they were just as bad. I bet they were just as bad as they were down in Sodom. Now, to argue against Lot for what he did, we can read the comments of Adam Clark, Jameson Fawcett Brown of the NIV Study Bible, that Lot greedily chose the land without considering who his neighbors were. And as Adam Clark says, in hindsight at least, the neighbors in Sodom and Gomorrah almost ruined Lot's body, soul, and family. Well, that's true, but that's hindsight. He may have taken a gamble and lost. John Gill says these wicked Sodomites, quote, were guilty of the most notorious crimes and addicted to the most scandalous and unnatural lust that can be thought of. Well, Gill was writing before 20th and 21st century America where, oh yeah, scandalous and unnatural lust can be thought of and not considered socially unacceptable anymore and written into the Constitution of the United States, not the Constitution, but in the Supreme Court decisions of the United States of America, because now homosexuality is just a preference. It's just somebody's lifestyle, and we can't say anything bad about it, or we'll be shut down in the academy, we'll be arrested for hate crimes, and so forth, depending on which Western post-Christian country you live in. But back then, when Gill was writing, homosexuality was a scandalous and unnatural lust. I don't know if they did fisting and rimming like modern-day homosexuals do, but if they did, not all modern homosexuals do that, let me be fair here, but a good percentage of them do. If they did that back then, that would just fit right in with their reputation as being sodomites. They committed these acts openly and publicly in the sight of God in the most daring and impudent manner and in defiance of him without any fear or shame. We go now to Genesis 13, verses 14 and 15. The Lord said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, "Now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward, eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and to your descendants forever." Now, how did God speak to Abram? Was it an audible voice? Was it a dream? I don't know. Adam Clark says that the Lord could have appeared to Abram as the second person of the Trinity, as Jesus, as a theophany. But however, it was communicated to Abram that, hey, you get all the land, north, south, east, and west. Now, if we assume that Lot was covetous when he looked at the plain of the Jordan, and again, that might not be so. I mean, Abram could have generously said, "No, you take what you want. I'm not going to complain about it." And Lot might have said, "Well, thank you, Uncle Abraham. I'll take the best place. You know, it doesn't look good," but maybe he wasn't covetous. But if he was covetous and selfish, Lot selfishly looked, saw those watered, well-watered valley east of the Dead Sea and down south in Sodom and said, "Hot dog." And then he got Sodom and Gomorrah for his neighbors. That's not so good. But Abraham, on the other hand, looked where God told him, and he got the promised land. So he who is first is oftentimes last, and that happened a lot. Now, this is one more confirmation of the land promise. "For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and your descendants forever." Notice it's not just to Abram, it's to Abram and his descendants. If you just say Abram inherited the promise, no, he didn't, because he wandered all over the promised land, all over Canaan land, and as a sojourner, as a stranger, he didn't own it all. But the descendants ended up owning it all, time of David, for example, time of Solomon. So you have to include the descendants in the promise, or the promise can be said to fail. All the land which you see, that's one of the three promises to Abraham, which were land, offspring, and blessings. Lob. Remember, think of Abraham at the tent lobbing a drop shot back over the net. So this is the land promise. Now, I'm not going to read them all to you. I've done that in previous audio, but there's a lot of them. Genesis 12, Genesis 13, Genesis 15, Genesis 17, Genesis 18, Genesis 22. All of those were land promises made to Abraham. The land promise was repeated to the descendants of Abraham, to Isaac in Genesis 26, to Jacob in Genesis 28, Genesis 35, Genesis 46, and incidentally also to Moses, who was a far descendant of Abraham in Exodus 3. So the land promise is quite prominent in the Old Testament, and it was reconfirmed to people more than Abraham. Let's go back. I failed to speculate a little bit on how Sodom got burnt up in the previous verse, so let me go back. There are various theories as to what destroyed Sodom and also Gomorrah. There's a large earthquake fault that runs right under the area near Zoar, and before this fault are large deposits of petroleum. When the plates in the fault shifted, they ignited the petroleum, and the pressure of those plates shot the ignited petroleum sky high, thus raining fire and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah. I think that's a pretty good explanation of it. When you read it in the text, it kind of sounds strange, like, where'd all this fire come from? Was there a volcano around there? I mean, where did it come from? But I think that makes a lot of sense. Shifting geographical plates, igniting the petroleum there. Now, notice a key word in verse 15, Genesis 13, verse 15, where we are now. God tells Abram, I will give this land to you and to your descendants forever. What does forever mean? Well, that sounds like an eternal promise. The problem is, of course, is the land didn't stay with Abraham forever. It was taken away by the Babylonians in 586, and there's the end of forever. Now, of course, this word creates a big theological controversy. There are dispensationalists who say that forever means forever, all world without end. Therefore, God's going to reestablish the land of Israel physically, geographically, geopolitically, forever and ever, which I don't believe because I'm not a dispensationalist. But even if you are a dispensationalist, you have to deal with something here. Forever means forever. What about that gap between 586 BC and 1948 AD when Israel was not given to the descendants of Abraham? I mean, forever means forever, not forever with a gap in it. The answer to this, of course, is that forever is olam, the Hebrew word olam, and sometimes it can be forever in the sense of eternity, and sometimes it can be translated as forever a long time. That's very easy to check out. I checked out the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew word in the Greek lexicons. I don't know Hebrew, so I can't do that, but this is not controversial. Olam means both a long time and eternal. We do this in English. The guy promises the girl he'll love her forever. Well, that can't be literal. The spouses are going to die. So what he means is, I'll love you for a long time until I die. Adam Clark takes the view, of course, that olam does not mean eternally. He says this, quote, this was always the design of God, not that Abram himself should possess it, but that his posterity should till the manifestation of Christ in the flesh. So forever until Jesus comes, and then that's the end of the descendants possessing the land. After that, it goes to spiritual, the covenants of God, the people of God move from the old Israel to the new Israel. Let me give you Strong's definition of olam, indefinite or unending future. An indefinite future is a long time. Unending future is eternity. You got your options there, indefinite or unending future. So if olam means a long time, and I submit to you it does here, you end up with covenant and also new covenant theology, one or the other. Those two theologies say that Israel is a type that lasted for a long time, not eternally, but a long time. Then the land as a type was superseded by the antitype, the new Israel, the Church of Christ. But we don't have time to get into that great theological battle. Let's go now to Genesis 13, verses 16 and 17. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, God continues speaking to Abram at Bethel, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. Now, the promise that the descendants will be is the dust of the earth. Genesis 22:17. Indeed, I will greatly bless you, God tells Abraham at that time, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore. As the sand which is on the seashore, which is the same thing as the dust of the earth. Here's another example in Genesis 28:14. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south, and in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Genesis 28:14, dust of the earth. Now these descendants, which are like the dust of the earth, include both physical descendants and spiritual descendants. I've just mentioned the physical descendants in those two verses from Genesis 22 and 28 that I just read to you, but also let's look at some other scriptures talking about physical descendants of Abraham. Numbers 23:10. Who can count the dust of Jacob, or number the fourth part of Israel? Who can count all that dust? Second Chronicles 1:9. Now, O Lord God, your promise to my father David is fulfilled, for you have made me king over a people as numerous as the dust of the earth. All right, so that's referring to Abraham's physical descendants. How about his spiritual descendants? Romans 4:13. For the promise to Abraham and to his descendants that he would be heir of the world was not through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. So the promise came to the descendants of Abraham. Verse 16, Romans 4. For this reason, it is by faith, in order that it may be in accordance with grace, so that the promise will be guaranteed to all the descendants, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Now, Abram was told to walk around the land of Canaan. Why? North, east, south, and west. The NIV Study Bible gives two options. One, perhaps to inspect the land, or maybe even to lay claim to the land. Option number two, I suspect that God's given Abram a sneak preview of what's coming. I don't know whether he's actually legally claiming the land, but he's getting to know the land that's once going to belong to his descendants. Now, that land that Abram is promised is contrasted with the land that Lot chose. Lot chose the most fertile land. He lost everything. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. Abraham was left with the less fertile land because of his sacrificial offer to Lot. But because of that, he was so prosperous that all the nations of the earth were blessing him. Application for that should be obvious if you want a sermon point. Give, and it shall be given unto you. Genesis 13:18, then Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. All right, Abram is moved now from Bethel. The second time he was at Bethel, he's gone down to Hebron. I'll read you about Hebron in just a minute. Let's talk about this phrase, the oaks of Mamre. This is probably a place of idolatrous worship, and that's why it had a special name, the oaks of Mamre. Mamre probably is a person that the oaks belong to. The land on which the oak trees were growing belonged to Mamre. I note that it's the oaks of Mamre. There's a modern oak of Mamre, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, is still there, allegedly, in the modern city of Hebron. And notice that this oak of Mamre is different from the oaks of Moreh, or the oak of Moreh. Different guy, Moreh, that's in Shechem, where Abram first came into the promised land. I always get those two mixed up because they start with an M. All right, well, let's read something about Mamre in Easton's Illustrated Dictionary. It means manliness. An Amoritish chief, Amorites are one of the big Canaanite tribes, or one of the big families back then. An Amoritish chief in alliance with Abraham, the name of the place in the neighborhood of Hebron where Abraham dwelt. Also called in authorized version, the Plain of Mamre. Different translation, but in revised version, more correctly, the oaks or the terebinths of Mamre. The name probably denotes the oak grove or the wood of Mamre, thus designated after Abram's ally. This grove must have been within sight of or facing Machpelah. The site of Mamre has been identified with Baalatet Selta, i.e. the oak of rest, where there is a tree called Abraham's oak, about a mile and a half west of Hebron. Now this is an Easton's Illustrated Dictionary written in the late 1800s. But I looked at Wikipedia. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, there's the Oak of Abraham, which is outside of Hebron. And it is the scrawniest, broken down, split up looking piece of firewood I've ever seen. It looked dead as a doornail. But I read somewhere, I can't remember, there was a shoot that was growing out of it that's keeping it barely alive. Here's what Wikipedia says about the Oak of Mamre. It's also called the Oak of Siptah. It's a site venerated by some as the Oak of Abraham, and distinct from the more ancient site of Mamre. It owes its name to an ancient tree, which seems to be dead but has a young sprig growing next to it, and stands on the ground of the modern Russian Orthodox monastery of the Holy Trinity. It is reported to have fallen in 2019. Well, made it all the way from Abraham's time to 2019 kaputz. Well, again, I don't know if this is really the same tree. I don't think anybody does. Let's talk about the city of Hebron, where Abraham moved to. Now, this is an interesting city. The name means a community or an alliance. It is a city in the south end of the valley of Eshcol, about midway between Jerusalem and Beersheba, from which it is distant about 20 miles in a straight line. If you look at the Dead Sea, it's about halfway down the Dead Sea to the west, a little bit of the coast, the northern end of the Negev, the southern desert. It was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. It still exists under the same name. And that was in the 1800s. Today, it's in the West Bank, Palestinian territory, in the land of Israel, and it's still called Hebron. It's one of the most ancient cities in the world. It rivals Damascus. Got the same name, even. Its earlier name was Kiriath Arba, according to Easton's here, citing Genesis and two places in Joshua. But, quote, Hebron would appear to have been the original name of the city, and it was not until after Abraham's stay there that it received the name of Kiriath Arba. Who Arba was, not the founder, but the conqueror of the city, having led thither the tribe of the Anakim to which he belonged. So, basically, the name's been Hebron ever since the days of Abraham. Abraham changed it, or somebody changed it, the name of Abraham, Kiriath Arba. And then the name was restored back to the original name Hebron when Caleb ended up receiving his possession in the Promised Land. This is according to the famous commentator Kyle. The name of the city does not occur in any of the prophets or in the New Testament. It is found about 40 times in the Old. It was the favorite home of Abraham. Here he pitched his tent under the oaks of Mamre, by which name it came afterwards to be known. And here Sarah died and was buried in the cave of Machpelah, which he brought from Ephron the Hittite. From this place the patriarch departed for Egypt by way of Beersheba. It was taken by Joshua and given to Caleb. It became a Levitical city and a city of refuge, so that the manslayer could flee from the avenger of blood if he had committed manslaughter. When David became king of Judah, this was his royal residence, and he resided here for 7.5 years, and here he was anointed as king over all Israel. It became the residence also of the rebellious Absalom, who probably expected to find his chief support in the tribe of Judah. And one part of the modern city is a great mosque, which is built over the grave of Machpelah. The first European who was permitted to enter this mosque was the Prince of Wales in 1862. It was also visited by the Marquis of Bute in 1866 and by the late Emperor Frederick of Germany in 1869. One of the largest oaks in Palestine is found in the Valley of Eshkol, about 3 miles north of the town. It is supposed by some to be the tree under which Abraham pitched his tent and is called Abraham's Oak. Well, I've already talked about the Oak of Mamre or the Oak of Abraham. I don't know whether it's the same oak or not. Let me give you what Wikipedia says about Hebron, a little bit more modern than Easton's Dictionary. A Palestinian city in the southern West Bank, 19 miles south of Jerusalem. Nestled in the Judean Mountains, it lies 930 meters above sea level, 3,050 feet, the largest city in the West Bank, and the second largest in the Palestinian territories after Gaza. It has a population of 215,452 Palestinians, this is in year 2016, and between 500 and 850 Jewish settlers concentrated on the outskirts of the old city of Hebron. Jews, Christians, and Muslims all venerate Hebron for its association with Abraham. It includes the Cave of the Patriarchs, which, according to tradition, is the burial site of the biblical patriarchs and matriarchs. Judaism ranks Hebron the second holiest city after Jerusalem, while some Muslims regard it as one of the four holy cities. Well, Hebron's a famous place, and that's where Abram has moved to now. Built an altar to the Lord for thanksgiving, either thanksgiving for the prevention of strife with Lot, or thanksgiving for the promise of God that Abram and his descendants would inherit the land. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm now finished with Genesis chapter 13, the whole chapter, verses 1 through 18. In our next audio, I'm going to take up Genesis 14, verses 1 through 16, where Abram gets himself involved in a little war and rescues his nephew Lot. We'll see you next audio. I hope you enjoyed this one.